Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Live Beyond podcast. My name is Jacqueline, and I am here again with Dr. Vanderpool and a very, very special guest who hands down has one of the most impressive resumes I think I've ever seen. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce her real fast and just be prepared to be wowed because it is incredible. But our special guest today is Jenny Dyer, and she is the founder of the 2030 Collaborative. As such, she directs the Faith-Based Coalition for Global Nutrition. She also directs the Faith-Based Coalition for the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria in partnership with the Friends of the Global Fight. Dyer teaches global health politics and policy as a lecturer in the Department of Health Policy at Vanderbilt School of Medicine, and she has taught religion and global health as a lecturer at the Vanderbilt School of Divinity. Dyer formerly served as the executive director to Senator Dr. Bill Frist's humanitarian organization, Hope Through Healing Hands in Nashville, Tennessee. And prior to that, she served as the National Faith Outreach Director for the Data Foundation in the One Campaign, which is Bono's organization from 2003 to 2008. In this role, she worked with religious leaders, authors, artists, and other faith-based leaders to promote awareness and advocacy for extreme poverty and global AIDS issues. Dyer has written several academic articles and opinion pieces on the intersection of religion and global health, and she has been published in numerous major news publications. She is the co-editor for the newly released The End of Hunger, Renewed Hope for Feeding the World, and she is also a contributor of Why Save Africa, Answers from Around the World, and a co-compiler of the Mother and Child Project, Raising Our Voices for Health and Hope, and the Awake Project, Uniting Against African AIDS Crisis. Dyer holds a BA in religion from Samford University, a Master's of Theological Science from Vanderbilt Divinity School, and a PhD in History and Critical Theories of Religion from Vanderbilt University. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So Jenny, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so excited. And I'm going to hand this over to Dr. Vanderpool to explain a little bit about what today is going to look like.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline. And Jenny, thank you so much for being with us today. We really do appreciate it. And we're talking about the first 1,000 days of a baby's life and the impact that has on the baby, the mother, and the community. And so we're so excited to have an expert on this time frame in our midst today. Jenny's a friend and colleague for many years now. And we really appreciate your input. Want to hear more about the 2030 Collaborative and your background in working in global health, development issues, hunger, first 1,000 days. Tell me all about that. How did that come around?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think Jacqueline probably gave the long version of that. So, the 2030 Collaborative is kind of the latest rendition, but even in listening to that, you know, I've been doing this work that I continue to do at the 2030 Collaborative, even today, that I was doing, you know, almost 20 years ago with the Data Foundation, which became the One Campaign, which is really working with faith leaders across the United States, and educating them and activating them to do more in the space of advocacy for global health issues. And I like to think about global health and global development as kind of, you know, these systemic issues, they all connect. I mean, y'all know this from all your work in Haiti. I mean, you can't do one thing without another. So while I still work on AIDS, TB, and malaria issues with the Global Fund, even today, as I did back in 2002, when it was first getting launched, as well as PEPFAR, but also have worked on issues around water, maternal and child health, hunger, vaccines, kind of the whole span of issues as it relates to health and systemic poverty. But it's important that the church understand these issues, and they do understand these issues, many of them, because they're on the front lines of missions often in developing nations, but also what more they can do. So things, you know, they may already be addressing some issues of poverty, but what else can they do? And often faith leaders overlook the important critical issue of advocacy. And that's really where I've spent the last 20 years working, making sure they know how important their voice is, letting their member of Congress know, doesn't matter the politics, that they care about those who are struggling with poverty in developing nations. And their voice will lend support and bolster legislation for those people, the world's poorest around the world. So that's it in a nutshell. And we continue to do that work with the 2030 Collaborative today.
Tell me, you mentioned the faith-based issues here. Why is it important for faith leaders to participate in this very interesting first 1,000 days of a baby's life?
Yeah, so honing in, in on hunger, and I've spent the last 6 or 7 years really working in depth on hunger. And hunger is kind of its own systemic issue, right? Like there's so many different issues around hunger, from acute hunger to chronic hunger, and every, the different phases of life affecting hunger. But I think that getting to the first 1,000 days of the child's life, right, from the moment of conception till really their second birthday, right, the first 1,000 days, we have, found through science over the last, you tell me, you're the doctor here, but over the last 30 years, that if we can really provide the correct nutrition during that magical window, the child is really set up with a foundation for life. If the child does not have access to the right nutrition in that first 1,000 days, then there's a whole array of issues that can happen physically to the child that is irreversible and will affect the child throughout the entire lifespan. So that's why it's so critical. And it's so critical for the faith community, I think, because the Bible calls us as Christians to provide food for the hungry, right? I mean, it couldn't be more clear. Tony Campolo would say there's 2,000 verses in scripture from Genesis to Revelation about feeding the poor and helping the poor. Wow. But I mean, Matthew 25, I think, is perhaps the clearest. We are to help feed the hungry. And with science, we know that there's no more important time than the first 1,000 days to feed the mother and the child and make sure that they have the right nutrition so that they can live full and robust lives that they were meant to live for the course of their life.
That's fantastic. Well, and you worked with Bono's One campaign for half a dozen years. Tell me what that particular group does for hunger and the related issues.
Yeah, so the One campaign came out of the Data Foundation. And I mean, years ago when we were working on AIDS, I mean, just to give a little context and background, it was the early 2000s. Christians really didn't want to talk about AIDS. It was a disease of sin, basically. And it was highly stigmatized, particularly in the United States. And Bono came in and said, no, this is an issue of moms and babies and children, and it's hollowing out societies in Africa. Franklin Graham, others, Bill Frist, they all had been there, seen it, knew it was a disease that was above all of us, and it would take everyone across the world to really stop this pandemic. But Bono was one of the first to say, and Christians should really be leading this. They should be at the helm of this. So he took it upon himself to travel across Middle America and speak from pulpits and really kind of rally middle or the heartland around this issue. And at the time, President Bush was the president. He had been elected largely by evangelicals. And with that evangelical support, President Bush was given kind of the leadership and support he needed to launch what was really his legacy piece, which was the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which today has supported with the Global Fund. I think it's 44 million people have been affected and their lives have been saved because of this. And that just started out with Bono and a tiny band of grad school students like myself. And it became the One campaign, which is now a huge organization that really is the leading campaign to rally Americans and people around the world. They have different sectors in different nations now to stand up, lend their voice for these issues, and really do the work of advocacy.
Isn't that fantastic? You know, when a celebrity lends, you know, his celebrity power to an issue such as this, a lot of things can really change and change rapidly. You know, one of the things I'm hearing you say is, you know, you're sort of discussing an intersection between religion and medical science. Mm-hmm. You know, and for me, as a physician, that's a fascinating intersection. How do you see that play out from your side, from the religion standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so important that we have the facts and we know the facts and we continue to seek the facts, you know, wherever anyone is on their religious spectrum. And it's important to have them. I mean, it's a part of, you know, the truth and knowing the truth and understanding the truth. So to have that in hand, and with the impetus and the calling to help the poor, I think it's kind of a 1-2 punch. I mean, I love working with folks like Dr. Paul Osteen, who hails from Lakewood, and he spends, you know, kind of like you guys, he's spending 3 to 6 months a year, and you guys may spend more, but, you know, in Africa doing this work. And there's a lot of medical missionary groups like him and others that are doing this work where they're at this very intersection of medical science and religion, applying what they've learned to heal people, or to provide them with food or clean water, because it's also a part of their faith. It's a powerful intersection when done well.
So many in the faith community would be a little resistant to incorporating medical science into their approach to this particular problem. What would you say to those people to encourage them that are not opposed to each other? These two different concepts are actually in concert with each other, especially in this particular format. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear. I mean, you're the doctor here, so I feel like I'm not the expert in the room here, but, you know, I mean, Jesus was a healer, right? I mean, that was part of his miracles. That was part of what he did and calls us to do too. And I think science only lends itself for the advancement of healing. And the thing about science is that it's continually evolving, if you will. I mean, there are mistakes in science, right? I mean, just like, because it's a human endeavor, but we continue, science allows itself to continue to seek the truth and seek out the problems and continue through trials to find the correct answer over and over. And this is why we're so lucky to live in the 21st century with penicillin and, you know, all the antibiotics, right. And the vaccines, frankly, that we have and the knowledge we have going back to the first 1,000 days, we wouldn't understand how important that was without the scientific method and the scientific process giving us wisdom into that critical time period and critical window. So I think you have to embrace science, you know, in its messiness, just like you have to embrace all humans, but also understand that the process in and of itself is seeking out the facts and the truth. And this is the best information we have to help others, frankly.
That's fantastic. I think that's great. Now, one of your more recent projects, right before the pandemic, that was good timing on your part, was that you have written a book, The End of Hunger, Renewed Hope for Feeding the World, came out in 2019. Tell us about that book. Tell us about writing that and who all you had with you to strengthen that book.
Yeah, so I brought it, the End of Hunger, just so I'd have it right here too. But yeah, it came out in 2019. And of course it was right before the coronavirus kind of broke out there in February and March of 2020. So sadly it doesn't incorporate the effects of what has happened over the last 2 years of COVID-19 on the hunger issues. just about the book a little bit, it is a collection of writers. I won't read them all, but there's Chef Rick Bayless to Brad and Kim Paisley, the country music stars, to Senator Frest wrote a piece, and Jeff Sachs has a piece. So it's this policy, medical doctors, chefs, artists. I mean, it's a collection of people who all come at hunger at different angles. Mm-hmm. So it provides kind of a unique full view of hunger and experience with hunger from a variety of different people. And it is for the church mostly. It's from a faith-based perspective. The book talks a lot about what now we call the three C's, but really the two C's there. Hunger, you know, is a complex issue. So it involves conflict often. So if we can, you know, Senator Frest has a huge piece on this. If we can work towards peace in a nation, usually you can address hunger, acute hunger, particularly for a population. The other issues are climate change. And that climate change can bring on, lack of water, lack of food, famine, starvation as well. So there's a lot of countries, the climate change interacts with the conflict. And then there's, you know, a lack of distribution of supplies and food in a nation too. And then COVID-19 has hit as the third C, which we don't address in the book, but now is being addressed everywhere. And that has really ramped up hunger issues to the tune of 40 to 50%. We're seeing it in the United States and we're seeing it around the world. Right. So where, you know, the World Food Program was feeding about 90 to 100 million people a year, they're now expected and need to feed about 140, 150 million people per year.
It's amazing.
Just to kind of give a wide range of what's going on here and around the world.
That's an amazing impact, isn't it? Just from a single virus can make that impact. We're seeing that in Haiti, about a 40% increase in child starvation. And it's just heartbreaking because along with that, we have conflict in Haiti. And so the delivery systems are very difficult. Just our logistics in Haiti has increased our costs and complexity just 100-fold. And so it's been a real challenge. Then in the midst of rising hunger, we're more challenged than ever on the delivery aspects, which should be the easy part, but unfortunately it's not. Well, so when you're talking about, the first 1,000 days, and looking at hunger, looking at that aspect of it specifically, how does hunger impact the first 1,000 days of a baby's life? What is that intersection?
Right. So I was thinking about this morning, and I've had the pleasure of working with Heidi Murkoff. I don't know if y'all know Heidi, but she wrote the What to Expect When Expecting. She kind of has that whole world. Now it's a website and everything. I just had books, 15 years ago when I was pregnant. But, Heidi is a friend as well. And she would say the first 1,000 days really starts even before, right? Day one, it's about making sure the mom is nutritionally ready to even get pregnant. I mean, that's the ideal. Mm-hmm. So it's pre first 1,000 days, really. But getting to the first 1,000 days, I mean, again, you're the doctor, but making sure mom has iron and folic acid and the right micronutrients and the right protein she needs, and being educated on that mm-hmm. she knows what she needs. And then after mom has the child, making sure that the child is breastfed for the first 6 to 12 months and has all the vitamins and antibodies and everything that the child can get from mom, but also has access to vitamin A and the other micronutrients the child needs, is the right protein, and making sure the child has access to clean water, all the right nutritional needs for mom and baby from zero to, from pregnancy to the second year of life. It's just really critical. And, you and I have talked about this before. If they don't get access to that, you can look at, the PET scans of the brain to see there's actually the synapses look different in a healthy child's brain from a child that has been what we call cognitively stunted. Mm-hmm. So the child is cognitively stunted. It shows up physically in the brain. The child is physically stunted, and you can see that on a height chart. versus an average child's height, who's been fed appropriately as they age, throughout the lifespan. So there's cognitive stunting, there's physical stunting, and this follows them because we know that through longitudinal studies that if they're cognitively stunted, they can't, they won't get the amount of education, same amount of education as someone who's not stunted will be able to do. So they might end their education in eighth grade, where someone who's healthy might continue through the 12th grade or beyond. We know they take less skilled jobs. They have higher rates of chronic disease throughout the lifespan. So it's a really important, again, going back to that important window to receive the right kind of care and nutrition they need for mom and baby.
That's outstanding. So what is your message to policymakers when you have low-income countries, and there are some 25 to 30, I think, low-income countries in the world today, where people are living on less than $2 a day? I know in our area of Haiti, about 80% of the population lives on less than $2 a day, which is a cutoff for extreme poverty, as we put it. So you've got a group of people that are subsistence living. So they're just searching for enough food to exist. They probably, the mothers, the grandmothers, historically have been stunted. They are underweight severely. So you're looking at a population that has generations of hunger. So when you're trying to transition these low-income countries from low-income into a more of a medium-income country, what is your message for policymakers? If you've got, say you've got 50% of your population that's cognitively stunted, how are they going to get ahead as a country? How are they going to improve? How are they going to, as a society, come into that middle income range where they can actually be successful and live long, happy lives? What is your message to these policymakers for that?
Well, I mean, that's a complex question, right? Because you, to your point, you can't solve the issues of a low income country with food alone, right? I mean, you just can't. You can't come in when people are already stunted and solve the issues, because they're systemic issues. So you have to attack the different issues of poverty, which includes healthcare, and it does include like job growth and economic growth and making sure mom can go back to work too, to provide that second income to dad, and making sure that mom can stay in school, making sure that the kids are staying in school. I mean, there's just so many different pieces to of course, addressing poverty. But when we talk with policymakers or members of Congress, first of all, the good thing about nutrition is that everybody is about combating hunger, right? I mean, this is not a controversial issue. I mean, Nobody wants to see anyone hungry or without clean water. That's kind of a baseline. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. I think everybody wants that. So the question is, how do we work together to do this? So we have wonderful mechanisms that over the last 30 years have greatly improved and become highly more efficient, like USAID, that provide funding and resources to prevent hunger in nations around the world. So for instance, USAID's Global Nutrition Program saves the lives of about 28 million children every year. And they focus solely on the first 1,000 days, so moms and babies. So that's millions of people's lives saved. And if I tell you so all of our foreign assistance, just as a reminder, is less than 1% of the US budget. So everything we spend in foreign assistance, from AIDS, TB, malaria, school, education, clean water, food, the whole spectrum, less than 1%. And the nutrition is actually 1% of that 1%. So we are talking about a fraction of money that we actually spend on hunger issues around the world. We could stand to spend a little bit more, frankly. But, and especially in a time of COVID and this increase, but that just gives you a reality check of what we're doing. This is not, we're not tithing, you know,
right.
10% of our US budget.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a quarter. This is less than 1%, but that just gives you kind of a foundation of what we're talking about here. But there are wonderful programs coming out of the US. We also are a partner and supporter for the World Food Program, which of course leads the world in providing food in developing nations, and particularly conflict areas hard to get to, like Yemen or southern Nigeria, you know, southern Sudan. They're going in there when they can to provide that. So the question is we just need policymakers and we need Americans to support their policymakers so that we can provide the right amount of funding and the right kind of legislation that's efficient and effective to combat hunger around the world, particularly for these kids.
That's outstanding. So, you know, there have been a lot of initiatives that have come and gone. Some of the ones that have been seemingly a lot more impactful have been the Millennial Development Goals and then the follow-on Sustainable Development Goals. And so in your experience, when you see, if you hear people say, well, we can't solve this issue, there's always going to be hungry people, you know, and mm-hmm. are we really improving? Have we really done anything? We've spent all this money. And are we seeing any impact? What would your response to that be?
I would say absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the untold story, I think, that the media doesn't shout loud enough. That is, over the last 30 years, the way in which we've attacked global health issues and global development issues, we've been able to really save the lives and of about 50% of people who were dying from AIDS and TB and malaria, maternal mortality, or even children. We've cut in half the number of kids who were dying every year. So child survival rates have been cut from these issues, and malnutrition is one of the highest reasons for child deaths under the age of 5. So the numbers are great. We know how to do this. The science has led the way. We've had the political will. We just need to keep this going. And going back to the Millennium Development Goals, or now Sustainable Development Goals, you know, ending hunger is the second sustainable goal. And the goal is set to end hunger by 2030. Can we do it? I don't know. I mean, we're now in a time of COVID and we're going, you know, there's a J curve. We're going back. The rates are going back up. So maybe not. We're going to have to mitigate these issues with COVID as it affects the supply and demand issues and distribution, as you were talking about earlier in Haiti. But I know that we know how to do it. The question is, will we do it? Will we have the political will to do it in the US and with other partner nations around the world? Will we join together to help the world's poorest? I mean, I love one of the articles by Will Moore in here, Onward to 2030, and it's so optimistic. And he really lays out how we would do this, how we will end hunger by 2030, what it would take. And it is possible. And, you know, we can, you know, put a man on the moon. We can create, you know, rockets to go to Mars, possibly. Can we feed the world? I think, yeah, we could. The question is, will we choose to do that?
I think that's a great answer. And I would love to, it'd be great to spend an entire, you know, series on how well we've done, you know, since 1990. I mean, the statistics are really favorable. In fact, when I sort of jumped into this, I was pretty pessimistic. And over the last 20 years, things have gone, you know, very well, which is amazing. And, you know, to your point, I know in our maternal health program, we've reduced maternal mortality by 75%. And the key indicator for that improvement was nutrition. absolutely the, by far and away, the biggest thing we could do was to make sure that these ladies had enough food. There, that many times they couldn't carry the baby to term because they were malnourished. And then they would hemorrhage because their blood counts were so low because they were malnourished and they didn't have the right minerals and nutrients that you mentioned earlier. And then just the defects that the babies would suffer from. In our area, we saw tremendous neurologic defects, and it was just simply because of mineral deficiencies. And so, and things that are so, so inexpensive to give. I mean, it's just
low resource. We're not talking, this doesn't require, you know, high tech interventions.
Right. It's just very, very easy. Feeding people is one of the easiest things you can do. So I think that's great. So the name of your organization, the 2030 Collaborative, tell us about that name. Where did you get that? And what is 2030?
Yeah, so back to 2030, you know, it's a nod at the Sustainable Development Goals, because that's largely where we work. So we work on these issues, all the issues we talked about today, with a number of different groups, and continue to work with a number of different groups to engage faith leaders across the U.S. on these important issues like hunger. Which, by the way, I forgot the one stat was that about 25% of the world was suffering from hunger in 1990. Today, it's less than 12%. So, you know, we have been able to cut in half hunger as well. So we just need to keep the momentum going to 2030 and see what we can do.
Well, and this, if my memory serves, in the 90s, we had 45 or so countries that were low income, and today we have about 25. And so, you know, that represents a tremendous success, because not only were you feeding these people and they were smart, you know, and they were able to work longer hours and get higher job levels and increased income and things like that, send their kids to school, but then that aggregated to the point where their governance changed and the government became a lot more susceptible to these improvements. And so it's just a neat snowball. We think, oh, we spend all this money in low tier countries, and if we don't have the goal of getting them us on a sustainable course to a middle income country, then, you know, that's a little tough. We need to have that, I think, clearly in mind, that we're taking care of this pregnant woman who lives in a mud hut, but the goal is to get a whole bunch of her out there so that the government will improve, the country improves, and then they get off of the list of countries receiving aid, you know. So that's
great. I mean, USAID, if you look at their program, it's called Journey to Self-Reliance, and they even have like a little track, you know, like a running track and measuring where the country is on the track to self-reliance. So that is the goal, right? Not to provide aid, and but really to be a partner to move these countries, as you say, out of being low income to being middle income, and moving out of chronic hunger, moving away from acute hunger, and then being able to provide for themselves. And it's a complex issue, but it's definitely possible. And that's the enthusiasm I think you've seen and I've seen over the last 20 or 30 years, that gives us the optimism that, you know, these things are possible.
Right, right. Well, and Bono saw that, as you've indicated, and the One Campaign. Where did that name come from?
Well, that's a good question. It originally came from 1%. We were asking the United States and other nations to give 1% of their budget toward foreign assistance. And we actually don't do that. We don't actually give 1% of the US. Britain does. So while we do give the greatest amount of money, we give a much lower percentage of money, if that makes sense. Right. So that's where that came. The 1% didn't have a ring to it. So I think it went to the One Campaign. Plus he had a good song called One, I think, that worked well for him. So
that helps. That's outstanding. Well, so if to the people who are listening, you know, they're not policymakers necessarily. What can they do? What role can they play in this situation that you've so described so well of taking care of mothers and their infants and producing a better society. What role can people play in that?
Well, there's a lot, and we have that in the book too, in the back. You know, obviously prayer is one way to play a role. There are wonderful philanthropies like Live Beyond that people can give their time and their money to, and it will be used, you know, efficiently and effectively towards ending hunger, towards these first 1,000 days issues. Then of course there's advocacy. If they're faith leaders, I would love to work with them. You can write me at Jenny@2030collaborative.com. And I'd love to get you on our list for letters. I know Dr. Vanderpool signs a lot of our letters that go to members of Congress. We kind of have a running list of about 200 leaders across the nation that sign. And that's a range of faith leaders regularly to support these issues. But then if you're just a soccer mom like me, you know, with a couple kids, you can easily go to senate.gov or house.gov, type in your zip code, figure out who your representative or senator is, and then send them an email or tweet them. And all you have to say is that you care deeply about the world's poorest. You care deeply about issues around hunger and you want to see the hunger solved. There's no magic. You don't have to have the policy and the, you know, all the legislation and stuff. You just need to let them know that you care and you support their leadership to uplift the world's poorest. And it takes like a minute of your time to
That's
do.
Great.
But it's so powerful. It's so powerful. I mean, I will say this one last anecdote. Senator Frist used to say, as majority leader of the United States when he was under President Bush, if he had 300 Americans, you may have heard this, David, 300 Americans write him an email or send a letter, whatever, it would come to his desk on an issue. So it doesn't take 330 million people calling in. It really just takes 300. I mean, that's the size of a small church,
right?
You know, a small community, a school, and that really moves the needle. So every voice counts so much for these issues.
That's a great point. And getting on to the Senate Majority Leader's desk would be quite a feat. That'd be fantastic. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate you and your fantastic work with the 2030 Collaborative. Just urge everybody to go to her website, 2030collaborative.com, and make sure you check out the book. Her book is just fantastic. I've read it. It's The End of Hunger, Renewed Hope for Feeding the World. And so a fantastic resource for this very topic of the first 1,000 days of a baby's life. Thank you so much, Jenny.